Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing great. How are you? I got some really good news today.
What's your really good news?
Really, really good news in the study in the UK came out just recently, says that pomegranate juice could help fight arthritis.
Now, do you have to inject the pomegranate juice, or can you just drink it?
Actually, first, I'm probably going to have to get arthritis, but if I should, the good news is that pomegranate juice can be an anti-arthritic.
So, if you have arthritis and you drink pomegranate juice, it should help your arthritis?
They're saying that it could have a beneficial impact on our arthritis. That's basically what they're saying, is that it could that it raises the level of antioxidants, which can reduce inflammation in the blood system and thereby help arthritis. Which I imagine there are other afflictions like gout and things like that it would help. We know that things like cherry juice help gout, so I could see, I can make that connection.
Now, I've always wondered, with something like this, we have a cocktail that we've made with pomegranate juice. does it help?
We turn pomegranate juice and pomegranate molasses into our house-made grenadine. So I got to think that, when I'm drinking that Jack Rose, maybe that's why I don't have arthritis right now.
Well,
might be exactly the reason. It's the Jack Rose saving my life.
The Jack Rose reminds me of a drink called the Pink Lady, which is a much maligned cocktail. Actually, the real version of a Pink Lady has no cream and is a very nice cocktail. And it's related to an old-fashioned cocktail called the Clover Club.
Mm-hmm.
And Julie Reiner, who's been on this show, who was the owner of the Flatiron Lounge in New York City, who's one of the top cocktail people in New York and therefore the country. Julie Reiner has opened her new place in Brooklyn, and it's called the Clover Club. And what's funny is,
cool name,
the cocktail was named after a gentleman's club called the Clover Club. Julie Reiner's new place is named after the cocktail.
And gentlemen are not allowed in.
No,
I'm just kidding.
But what goes around comes around, isn't that, great? So if you want to try a Clover Club, you can come to our restaurant and try one. If you want to go to the Clover Club, you've got to go to Julie Reiner's place in Brooklyn.
Well, you hear us talk a lot about real ingredients, pomegranate juice, pomegranate molasses, making our own grenadine, all those kinds of things. We talk about it a lot. Francis, I didn't talk to you about this before, but I was in the supermarket the other day, and I walked past one of those shelves with the Mr. T's bar mix and all the other stuff.
Did you kick it over?
No. I said, you know what? I make fun of these things all the time because they taste bad.
Yeah.
Okay? Because I do. I make fun of those things all the time, margarita mix and blah, 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 because they taste bad.
Hey, I have a margarita mix at home. I keep a lime in my refrigerator, and I keep salt in my counter, and
I go tequila.
I keep some tequila, which you have to put in the margarita mix anyway, and I keep some sugar.
Uh-huh.
And you know what I call that?
Yeah.
Margarita mix. You know what else I call it?
Yeah.
Food!
Anyway.
Oh, and you know what I do to stabilize it? Nothing.
Okay, Francis, and yeah. I'm being totally honest here. I picked up some of the margarita mix and the sour mix, and it's the one I picked up that I thought, okay, there's going to be an ingredient here that I recognize. Strawberry margarita mix. Okay. Picked up the strawberry margarita mix off the shelf.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. No lemon. No lime. No strawberry. Okay. I got strawberry margarita mix, and I swear to you, the only ingredients that I recognize as food,
mm-hmm.
number one, obviously, high fructose corn syrup.
Right.
Number two, citric acid.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Sounds delicious.
Okay. There is no other ingredient in that you would even recognize as food. And it's called strawberry margarita mix.
Okay, here are the two things.
How do you see? This is the part that I don't understand about the world we live in today. And here I am back. You yelled at me for being on my high horse the other day, and here I am back there again.
It's a big horse.
It's a big horse called Tank. But How do you get to put strawberry anything on the label and have a strawberry-free beverage?
Well, you know what's funny? I think that if you put strawberry on the strawberry...
If you put milk on a container and it didn't have any milk in it, wouldn't we get mad?
Yeah, I think that you can put... I think if you put strawberry quick, for example, like it's powdered, you know there's no strawberries in there. But if it's a strawberry margarita mix and it doesn't have any strawberries in it, I agree with you. But I also have to say... We're so divorced from wondering. You know what? I wonder if there's an absence of curiosity. Is it just that there's an absence of curiosity that people say, you know, I wonder what's in a margarita? Mm-hmm. Well, tequila, triple sec or Cointreau, and margarita mix. Well, you know what's in, you know how I make my margaritas? It's tequila, Cointreau or triple sec, sugar, and lime juice.
Right.
From a lime.
From
it's, what's
lime.
The mix? What's the mix?
Right. Sugar and lime juice is your mix.
So okay? I don't get it.
There's no high fructose corn syrup. There's no...
Stabilizer, nothing.
Stabilizer. There's
do you
a,
know?
I mean, I can't... Honestly, I can't even tell you the other ingredients because there's no way for me to possibly remember them because I have no frame of reference to remember those words.
Do you know what? I actually have a trick for storing my lime juice at home to keep it fresh. You know what? You know how to keep my lime juice in at home to keep it fresh?
The fridge I'm going to go with.
No, the lime itself. I keep it right. It stays fresh.
You made me laugh. You get points for making me laugh today. Excellent.
Oh,
great job.
Oh, Lord. You know what's funny?
Lime. That's good. I thought you were going fridge. I got to tell you, I thought you were going for the cold thing.
No. You know what's funny is here we are talking about how to eat healthfully, and we're talking about margaritas.
Yeah.
We can't even – I mean, like – You can't even manage a margarita. I'm not asking you to make a cake. You don't have to put the dough in and let anything rise. Just make your own margaritas.
Yeah, we didn't even ask you to mill your own cereal. Okay, we didn't even ask for that. We just asked you to squeeze a lime.
Yeah, it's funny because we have to be the only show on the airwaves talking about how to healthfully make cocktails.
And you probably have. Here's the other part about this. The guy who was making the margarita mix probably has a $400 juicer on his shelf.
Mm.
Okay, there's probably a juicer on the shelf. I don't get it. By the way, just I have to add this just for fun.
Okay.
The other thing that you can buy relatively inexpensively, and you don't if you want to, is one of those little ice crushers.
Mm-hmm.
And making a real margarita and pouring it over crushed ice, or making real cocktails, pouring them over crushed ice, really cooling, refreshing way to make cocktails in the summertime.
I agree.
Don't be afraid of the ice crusher. My fridge has a little ice crushing mechanism.
Uh-huh.
I don't think the people at GE were ever thinking, or LG were ever thinking that I was going to be making strawberry daiquiris with their crushed ice.
It's all about the real, and if you go pick up the Mr. Boston Guide, which the old editions are terrible, but the mm-hmm. most recent
Yeah, make sure you get a new edition.
07-08.
This is not something you should go to the library and look up because the old editions are not so great.
But go get the Mr. Boston Guide to cocktails. Go get Dale DeGroff's book on cocktails, and you can make some fresh stuff at home. You don't need a mix. Most cocktails are really easy to make, and there's 100 million times better than buying a mix.
I mean, we're talking about under a minute to create the ingredients for these things. It's not like you gotta make a veal stock. You know, most of the ingredients in these cocktails are very, very quick.
Anyway, so there's our advice to how to healthfully eat and drink cocktails.
So cool. Buy some pomegranate juice, squeeze your own lime, have a good time.
And by the way, you know what you want? We'll put this up on our website, but you want to check if you want to make sours, and sours are very underrated.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to make a sour, the way you make it rather than a sour mix, here's what a sour mix is. It's one part lime, two parts lemon, three parts simple syrup, which is sugar water.
Sugar water, equal parts sugar and water, that's it.
So it's one part lime, two parts lemon, three parts simple syrup, and an egg white. And you throw that in with whiskey and shake it on up and you have a whiskey sour. You throw it in with apricot brandy and you have an apricot sour.
Yep.
You know, and they're so much better that way. So drink well. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:15.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC with The Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Joining us from his home in Italy is Andrea Feluga. Andrea Feluga is the managing director of Livia Feluga Wines in the Friuli region of Italy. They are very traditional wines and very special wines, and we're happy to have them on the show today.
Andrea, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you, and hello to everybody.
Let's introduce your wines. Let's introduce the Friuli region to some of our listeners who may not know about your wines. Friuli is an ancient winemaking region, but your father, Livio Feluga, began his estate in the late 20th century, right?
In the
1970s, right?
In the 1950s.
In the 1950s, yes.
Because actually, Friuli, we usually shorten as Friuli, but the full name of the region is Friuli Venezia Giulia, is located in northeast in Italy, and that's really a crossroad. We border with the former Yugoslavia, we border with Austria, and we are at the top of the Adriatic Sea. And I said that because actually my family also moved after WW2 from one side of the Gulf of Trieste to the other side of the Gulf, where we live now. And unfortunately, we lost everything, all the properties we had traditionally, because that part of the world became Yugoslavia after WW2. So my father started, it's five generations that my family is involved in winemaking, but my father started his own business, actually just before WW2, but then started again in the 50s. That was too long, but I answered to your question.
Here in the United States, we have people, you know, families. You know, the Mondavis are considered a long-reaching family because they've had three generation, and I guess they're now getting into their fourth generation people getting involved in the wine world. You know, your family's already on their fifth generation, and in Italy, that isn't necessarily a long time.
Well, other families that are longer involved in winemaking, because I mean winemaking in Italy is a very traditional activity. Sorry, this is my dog Agatha, a little bit agitata, and so it's natural to be involved. It's very common to be involved in winemaking, but we all should consider that the Italian wine scenario definitely changed after WW2, because before that time, a lot of wine was produced in Italy, but most of it was sold for local consumption in big containers, as a wine of the house. And so, probably, with few exceptions, some Barolo, some Brunellos, and some Chiantis, most of the wine that we now drink at the restaurant were bottled and were companies that really started bottling the wine and marketing the wine after WW2. And so, in spite of the number of the generations involving winemaking, I think that what is very important is what my father did after WW2. Actually, if I can say that, he was the first of, in bottling the wine in the Friuli area, and he started in 1956. Bottling the wine with the traditional, became traditional Met label. I, you know, but I hope that some listeners know as well that our label shows a piece of land, a piece of the environment where the wine, a piece of Friuli, I would say, it's made out of an ancient map of the area. And the idea of my father in the 50s was to show the consumer where the origin of the wine, where the wine came from.
And that map.
I apologize if I hope you can understand my really bad English.
No, you're doing fine. Now,
okay, thank you.
So we're talking about the maps on the label and the region being very important.
And that's kind of one of the trademarks of the wines. That's one of the things that's happened. Is the map of the area is now part of the label.
You're right, and consider that in Italy, all over Italy, I mean, the law that established the idea of the what we call DOC, the Denominazione di Origine Controllata, I mean the law that states the origin of the wines, or the AOC in France. I don't know much about the U.S., but I think you have similar rules. I mean, that law in Italy was released in 1963. So my father was a kind of a pioneer in having the approach of showing the consumer and telling the consumer where the wine comes from.
Now, your father was a pioneer in...
Because, that happened in 1956, so it's almost 10 years in advance.
Now, for a long time, in the United States, we didn't have the appreciation of Friulian wines. You know, the appreciation of Italian wines in the United States for a long time was confined to Chianti and then grew to, you know, Brunello and Barolo. And only in, I would say, the last 10 or 15 years or so have... Among the wine cognoscenti, you will find people who are enamored of Italian whites and who have now, there's a real fascination with Italian whites. And your winery makes some of the most unique and old-fashioned, it seems to me, white wines in all of Italy. Is there a different style?
Why don't we call them traditional instead of old-fashioned?
Yeah, is there a style that's specific to what you want to do with white wines that makes them uniquely Feluga and uniquely Friulian?
Well, first of all, I think that what we can do is just a piece of the final result. I mean, the characteristics of our wine are above all made out of the terroir, out of the environment, where we work. I mean, in the climate and the soil that where we grow the vineyards. And anyway, I think that you're right. We're not very well known worldwide, also because the production of Friuli is very small. If you consider Friuli, as the whole production of the region, is about 1.5 million of hectoliters out of about 50 million of hectoliters produced in Italy. So it's small percentage. And that's why it's not very popular. It's not a popular wine. But people who know wine, let me say that in Italy, everywhere in Italy we produce great wines, but traditionally, out of the 20 or 21 regions in Italy, three of them are considered to be the most important. I mean, Tuscany, Piedmont, and Friuli. And obviously, Piedmont and Tuscany are famous for the production of red wines, and Friuli is traditionally considered the number one producer, number one in terms of quality. I mean, not necessarily in terms of quantity, but number one producer of white wine. So in Italy, we have this kind of approach or feeling. Worldwide, being the production so small, and maybe I would say also the interest in white wines is not, compared to the interest in red wines, is a little lower. So these two factors, how can I say that? These two factors... because of these two factors, the Friulian wines are traditionally not very well known. But yes, we maintain the style in the tradition of Friuli. Even if I have to admit to say that every year we change a little things in order to be updated and in order to achieve the goal of producing a better and better wine.
Well, you know,
so even if the style never changes, but the technology does, and some knowledge, of course, every year the knowledge in winemaking every year after year is better, and we try to implement all of that in order to make better and better wines.
Well, you know, one of the interesting things that happens in the United States is the Italian wine that sort of took America by storm was inexpensive Pinot Grigio, and most of the inexpensive Pinot Grigio here in the States was from the Alto Adige and was, you know, Santa Margarita's, you know, basically generic Pinot Grigio. And a lot of people who are just entering the world of wine are very comfortable ordering a Pinot Grigio. Your Pinot Grigio from Friuli is really an extraordinary wine, and I find it very useful in the restaurant because it's a way that I can make someone still feel comfortable, like they have something familiar. They know it's a Pinot Grigio. And then I can introduce them to a wine in your Pinot Grigio from Friuli that's true to the terroir, that's a whole nother category of complexity. And then when I get them to open their eyes that way, I can maybe take them through the rest of the white wines of Friuli. Do you find that the Pinot Grigio is your number one wine in the United States?
Yes, I do. And let me, I try to say some words about Pinot Grigio. I understand that sometimes it's considered to be an easy wine. But you should consider that, first of all, Pinot Grigio, as I know, in the United States, for instance, Pinot Noir, it became very, very popular. And Pinot Bianco is a wine that I do love. It's not very much produced in the area. Actually, it's not very much produced in the world, but when you find a good bottle of Pinot Bianco, that's for sure a great wine. So there's no reason for Pinot Grigio not to be a great wine. So for sure, the variety has a great potential. I think that since the demand is so huge, probably some of the producers just don't focus enough on the quality of the wine. I mean, also because many times the producer is looking for an easy wine, and so let's give to the consumer an easy wine. It's everybody's happy. I'm sure that the potential of the variety is very qualitative. It is very, in terms of quality, is very high. And also, there are three factors affecting the result of the wine. First of all is the varietal, so the genetic aspect. Then is the winemaker objective, so the winemaking tools, the winemaking goal. And this can be very high in terms of quality or just a little lower. And then, of course, the quality of the wine is affected by nature. So, I mean, it's affected by the soil and the climate. The terroir, what the French call the terroir. So, if you consider the wine we produce, our wines are estate bottled in one of the most suitable areas for growing white vines all over Italy, I would say, and for sure for growing white wines, one of the best all over Italy. We have a very poor soil, and so the yield is very, very low. We have a very high goal in terms of quality, so we keep the vigor of the vines very low. And as I told you, the yield is very low. Our goal is to reach a perfect maturation of, how do you say, ripening or ripening?
Ripening. What we're talking about, and some of our listeners may not realize, is that when you have poor soils, that's actually often very good for wines, because when you have rich soils, you grow a very healthy plant. But when you have poor soils like you have in parts of Friuli, the vine needs to work very hard to send its roots in deeper, and with great care can make better grapes, which make better wine.
Andrea, when we come back...
Thank you for your support.
No problem. When we come back, I want you to talk about a little-known grape that's produced in your region, but really, really special wine that people who've had never forget, and that's Piccoli.
We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:45. The Feluga family at the Livio Feluga Winery are masters of modern winemaking and at the same time rooted deeply in Italian tradition. Founder and patriarch Livio Feluga has been counted among the seven most influential Italian winemakers in the last 100 years. Signore Feluga pioneered the Friuli method. It's a style of winemaking that focuses on the purity of the fruit and the expression of the soil. It's made Livio Feluga Pinot Grigio the standard bearer for high-quality artisanal Pinot Grigio. It's serious, interesting, deeply rooted wine that speaks of the very essence of Friuli, from whence it comes. But with Livio Feluga, it's not only Pinot Grigio. Feluga wines offer a world of adventurous choices. Have you ever had a wonderful Ribolla Gialla or a Picolit? Well, if you haven't, then you're missing some very special Italian wine indeed. Feluga makes red wines like Verdigo, which is Cabernet and Merlot, or Sasso, which is made with the Italian grapes Refosco and Pignolo. Start with Pinot Grigio, the way it's supposed to be, and then, through the efforts of Livio Feluga, take a tour of Friuli, glass by glass, sip by sip. Ask for Livio Feluga wines at your local wine shop, or look for them online. Tell them you heard about it on The Restaurant Guys. Hello, everyone, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And our guest today is Andrea Feluga. Andrea is the son of Livio Feluga and manages the Livio Feluga Winery in the Colle Orientale del Friuli in Italy. And we're talking to him today from his home in Italy. Andrea, we talked about Pinot Grigio and how, you know, Feluga Pinot Grigio is sort of, to people who are used to sort of generic Pinot Grigio, you'll order a Feluga Pinot Grigio, and it's a sort of shocking.
Surprising.
And it opens people's minds to go and look at some of your other white grapes, and you produce some pretty traditional Italian white wines from grapes like that people, that Americans may not have heard of, like Picolit or Ribolla Gialla. Talk to us about your more traditional grapes, like those two, for example.
Well, and for sure, Picolit is something really special and unique. Picolit is produced in the Colli Orientale del Friuli district only, and it's indigenous to that area. And we are the largest producer of Picolit in the world, and we make 10 hectoliters of wine only out of more than 4 hectares of vines or vineyard.
Tell people how many barrels that might be.
Four or five barrels.
So basically 100 cases of wine. And you're the largest producer in the world.
Yes.
So it's pretty special.
I mean, the yield is almost, it's very, very low. It's almost nothing because the vine is affected by a genetic disease. It's called flora abortion. And that happened because the timing of flowering, let's say the time when the male part of the flower and the female part of the flower are ready to produce the fruit do not coincide perfectly, so blossoming is very difficult, and out of one bunch of grape, only a few berries can grow. So naturally the yield is very, very low, but those few berries are very much concentrated have a high concentration of sugar and aromas and acidity as well.
And Picolit also has a very unique flavor and aroma, and it's not inexpensive, but there's nothing in the world like Picolit, right?
You're right. It's both the things are right. It's not inexpensive because the yield is very, very low, and it's unique because it's not made out of a technology, but it's just the genetic of the vine, of the varietal.
And let's talk about Ribolla Gialla. Now, your family originally comes from a part of Italy that is no longer part of Italy. And Ribolla Gialla was traditionally grown in northern Italy and also in eastern Europe. And we're now seeing Ribolla Gialla again. We have a Ribolla Gialla section on our wine list. We love the grape.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it's great.
It's
a ton of fun. Talk to us about this grape that no American had heard of until 5 years ago.
Well, I would say it's all kind of on the opposite side, because the Ribolla vine is really generous, and the vine has the berries of Ribolla Gialla are quite big, but it's a typical varietal of this area, and it's not that much aromatic, but we love it. It's not that much alcoholic with high acidity. And so it's not a very complex wine, but it's a wine that we love, and it's it's really it's a food wine. It's really nice to food to match a Ribolla Gala with a lot of food.
That's exactly what I was going to say. You know, Ribolla Gialla, and Ribolla Gialla goes from very, very simple wine to a fairly complex wine, depending on how it's made. But it is always a great wine with food. And that's so many people overlook how the wine marries with the food that you're eating that I don't understand sometimes the way people pick the wines.
Well, and I'll talk to you about something else. You know, it's funny. When we talk about Pinot Grigio, there is some really, I'm sorry to say, there's some terrible Pinot Grigio on the market here in the United States. And there is some amazing Pinot Grigio, like Mr. Faluga's Pinot Grigio, on the market in the United States. But Ribolla Gialla, I don't know what's available in Italy. But every Ribolla Gialla that I have had in the United States, whether it's from Czechoslovakia or from Italy, has been amazing.
Or Slovakia, right? If it's not amazing, it's very, very interesting.
Do you think that is, Mr. Faluga? Do you think that's because no one's going to grow it? You know, there's a reason to grow sort of generic Pinot Grigio, but there's really no reason to grow Ribolla Gialla unless you're going to make a good one.
Yeah, I think that's the reason. Even if I would never say that a wine is not, as you said, that you can find Pinot Grigio. Well, let's say it's less good than another one, but I would never say that I had a bad wine. I mean, wine, I always respect any kind of wine. Sorry if saying that.
No, it's okay.
That's
okay. I've just had some bad wine. move to New Jersey. I promise you we'll bring you some bad wine.
Yes, but I agree with you. The demand, it's a tiny demand of the wine, and so I'm sure that every producer puts the best efforts in making the best wine as possible. And as you probably, when you said more complex wines, you referred to wines that the Ribolla Gialla that are led to a very high maturation with the ripening is very, very stressed and you can find very interesting wine. I agree with you.
Well, and you know, I want to turn the topic I love the area of Friuli, and one of the things that we're finding more and more from Friuli, which is a cooler region than most of the great red wine producing regions of Italy, and which is one of the reasons why it's famous for white wines. However, I'm seeing in the United States more and more high quality reds coming from Friuli, which 10 years ago I didn't really know about, but you guys grow Merlot and Cabernet Sauvignon as well as some native varieties of red up there. What's red wine from Friuli all about?
Well, maybe it's surprising you, but just after WW2, the majority of wine made in Friuli was red. And even if, as you said, it's a cool area. And most of the red wine made in Friuli is Merlot, because, I mean, Napoleon came to the area, and Merlot became a traditional varietal that replaced most of the indigenous varietals grown in the area. So I'd say that the most traditional red grape in the region right now is still Merlot. But in the last 15 years, we started to recover sometimes almost disappeared indigenous varietals, and we are getting some satisfaction out of those as well. Refosco da Peduncolo Rosso, Schioppettino, Pignolo, varietals like those. Cabernet Sauvignon. In the Cabernet family, traditional of Friuli is Cabernet Franc, Cabernet Franc, more than Cabernet Sauvignon. Cabernet Sauvignon was a recent introduction, and it's probably Friuli is not the best environment to grow Cabernet Sauvignon.
Well, but talk to us about Refosco. Now, Refosco, we may have heard of before in the United States, but we don't see it very often. Refosco is a traditional grape of Friuli.
Yes, it is. It's native to Friuli, to the northern part of the Colli Orientali del Friuli, and was the family of Refosco. There are quite a big range of BOTP of different kinds of Refoscos, and some of them originally were grown in the East Japan Peninsula as well as some of them were grown in the northern part of the Friuli Venezia Giulia region. So anyway, in this area, in northeast of Italy, it's indigenous of this area, yes.
Well,
and we grow, we have a very old vineyard over the Foscolo, and we use that vineyard to produce our top red wine.
Well, I'll tell you, Mr. Faluga, it's been wonderful to have you on the show. Your wines are an education, and it's been lovely to talk with you.
Oh, that was my pleasure. Thank you very much for
inviting
me.
Thanks so much for being with us today.
You can find out more about the wines of Livio Faluga that Andrea Faluga produces now and his father's winery if you go to liviofaluga.it. Of course, you can link there from our website, restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back in just a moment. 1450 WCTC, the time is 11:55. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. You know, the estate, you know, Livio Faluga, his father, was given a Lifetime Achievement Award, a European Lifetime Achievement Award for outstanding service in the field of wine. These wines, they're great. Faluga wines are great. And the thing is, they are fairly widely available, at least around the Northeast.
But, you know, Francis and I talk about this all the time. The wines from Faluga taste like from where they come. And that's so important to me. As a restaurant owner, I don't want my Pinot Grigio from Friuli to taste like my Pinot Grigio from the Alto Adige. I don't want my Cabernet from California to taste like my Cabernet from Bordeaux. And in the wine world, there's a battle going on, and Francis and I talk about the battle a lot. And the battle is, everybody's trying to get a big score, and anything to get a big score, even if it means, you know, making your wine more generic, making your wine taste less like your wine, and making it taste more like someone else's.
Well, and that
wine.
Battle is starting to turn the other way, and people who are really into Faluga's wines are fanatical about it. Mm. Although, you know, it is very interesting to be in the restaurant business when people order a Faluga Pinot Grigio. I like to be at the table when it's opened, you know, or I make sure that the sommelier is looking directly in the eyes of the person who's tasting it, because it is, if you're not used to it, you say, well, that's totally different. It's funny with these real wines, you can have a situation where people say, oh, this wine isn't right.
Right.
Like, no, all the wines you've been drinking till now aren't right. But this wine is exactly
or right. Or even so, you know, why do I want to have five Pinot Grigio on the list that all taste exactly the same as one another?
Yes, but you know what? That's one of the great things about being in our business, because folks in our, and the reason I tell the sommelier to be there is to reassure the person. And, you know, we taste the wine before we open the bottle. Informal service in a restaurant, the waiter or captain tastes the wine to make sure it's not corked and to make sure it's right. And then we present that wine to you. This is another advantage of that, because if someone who may not be familiar with Faluga's style sees our captain or sees one of us open the wine, taste it to make sure it's right, and then pour it, the reaction is more likely to be, hey, this is something I haven't seen before, knowing that, you know, Mark and Francis have said it's okay, and they'll look for something interesting. Whereas I think in the semi-formal service, where you sort of open the bottle in the air and just pour it for the customer to try, that they're left to think, oh, is that not right? And they're unsure.
Yeah, who wants to go to a wine list and say, well, what's this Pinot Grigio? Well, that's the $27 one, sir. And this one? Well, that's the $34 one, sir. Well, and this one? Oh, that's our $49 one.
And the only way a staff is going to get to know how to taste wines with any breath is for the staff to taste the wines
as
well.
And the only way you're going to have wines that matter is if the winemaker makes a choice to make his wines taste differently than the winemaker from another part of the world.
Let's go have a glass of Pinot Grigio.
Excellent.
I hope you've enjoyed listening to The Restaurant Guys. I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. Time is 12 noon.